Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is mastering engineer Pete Lyman of Infrasonic Mastering in Los Angeles. Before we get to Pete, how much does your favorite artist cost? You're an oil billionaire, and you're throwing a birthday party, and you want to hire your favorite artist. How much would he or she or the band cost? Well, there was an interesting article in priceonomics.com, and it listed a couple hundred artists and what the prices are. So just as a sampling, at the superstar level, which is $1 million plus, you have artists like Bruce Springsteen, Madonna, James Taylor, which surprised me, Bon Jovi, Justin Bieber, Justin Timberlake, Taylor Swift, the Dave Matthews Band, and more and more and more. And that's no surprise, really, because everybody expects them to make that kind of money. In the $750,000 plus range, you have Lady Gaga, Coldplay, Rihanna, Adele. Still a lot of bread for just one gig. At $500,000 plus, you have Foo Fighters, Pink, Rascal Flatts, and the Black Eyed Peas, among many others. In the $100,000 plus price range, you have Blake Shelton, Avicii, Alicia Keys, and 50 Cent, among many others. Now, here's where it starts to get interesting as we get below that 100K price level. At 50K, we have Adam Lambert, Bare Naked Ladies, Colby Calais, Lana Del Rey, among many others. From $30,000 to $50,000 is Ben Folds, Cheap Trick, Joan Jett, and Trombone Shorty. That's a surprise. Trombone Shorty is great. I didn't think he was making that kind of money. In the $20,000 to $30,000 a night range, there's Allo Black, which I think at this point, because he has a hit, he's probably more expensive than that. You can get George Clinton. You can get Los Lobos. You can get Macy Gray. Now, see what's happening. As we get farther and farther away from a hit, you get less and less money. Still okay per night, but it's a whole lot less than when you're at your peak writing on a hit. In the $10,000 to $20,000 night range, Candlebox, Fuel, The Crystal Method, Vanessa Carlton. And here's what I find interesting. $1,000 to $10,000 per night. Bo Bryce, King's X, remember them? I always thought they'd be a little more expensive than this. The Bodines, once again, remember them? And the Dave Matthews Tribute Band. Boy, it's pretty bad when a tribute band is getting paid more than you are and you had a hit. Anyway, it's really, really interesting to look at these prices, but keep in mind that they're retail prices. In fact, they may go for far less. So this is just kind of the asking price of the agent, but it's still pretty interesting to look at. So go over to priceonomics.com, and there you can look at a whole bunch of booking prices, and I think you'll find it really interesting. The next thing I want to talk about is mixing with mastering in mind, which is kind of apropos that we have Pete Lyman on the show today. First of all, let's just look at a number of things that you have to be aware of when you're mixing that will just make your mastering engineer's life so much easier. The first thing is don't over EQ when you're mixing. And that's really easy to do. But what ends up happening a lot of times is you just make your mastering guy's hair fall out because they're trying to overcome your over EQing. You're always better to do less than more. Another big thing is over compressing when you're mixing. Yeah, your clients really want a loud mix, and there's no way around it. These days, we have to give the clients what they want, and they want something really loud. But you're really limiting your mastering engineer's ability to help you when you turn that mix in as the final mix. You're a whole lot better off if you take off the limiting and compression on the master bus, or at least lower it somewhat, just to give the mastering engineer a little bit more room to work with, because usually they can do a better job at that than you can. One thing to remember, though, levels between songs aren't important, and some mixing engineers worry a lot about that, that one song is the same sounding as the next. That's what mastering engineers do. It's one of their primary jobs, and that's what they're really good at. So that's one of the things that you shouldn't worry about. The other thing you shouldn't worry about is getting a really hot mix, because again, that's what mastering engineers do better than anybody. So leave that to them. One thing you should do is watch your fades and all your trims. So for instance, sometimes a mastering engineer will find that something is trimmed too tight, where there's the reverb at the end that is cut off. Or sometimes there's something at the beginning of the song, the initial attack of the song is cut off. So that can be a problem. So give yourself a lot of room on either side of the mix and let the mastering engineer tighten that up for you. A big thing that you should always worry about is printing your mixes at the highest resolution you can. So in other words, always give a 24-bit mix to the mastering engineer. And I'm assuming everybody is mixing a 24-bit. I hope you are. If you're mixing at 96K, that's the resolution you should give your mastering engineer. It should be 9624. If you're mixing at 44.1, which I hope you're not, that's what you should be giving to your mastering engineer. But make sure it's 24 bits, because that's the way the mastering engineer can help you the most. The other thing is alternate mixes can really be your friend. Alternate mixes meaning you should always print an instrumental mix, a vocal-only mix, a whole bunch of things like that can be really helpful. A TV mix. TV mix is basically everything but the lead vocal and maybe a lead instrument. But what's a lifesaver many times is that instrumental mix, sometimes that vocal mix. Let's just say there's something that isn't quite loud enough. There's a phrase that's being lost. Well, the mastering engineer, using a combination of the vocal-only mix and the instrumental mix, can fix that for you. So it's always a good idea to print those alternate mixes, because they can be a lifesaver in mastering, and they can save you from having to go back and doing a recall and doing it again, and usually that will save a day or so anyway. And finally, there's a couple of things that you should really be aware of if you're going to cut vinyl. First of all, and this applies to CD as well, know your song sequence. Know which song follows which in the course of the album. That's really important, because it will take up a lot of time, a lot more time than you think, if you go to mastering and don't have this figured out. So you should know in advance what that should be. And finally, have your songs timed out, and it's especially important for vinyl, because don't forget, it sounds best if you have 18 or 20 minutes per side, and maybe you can get 25 minutes a side, and that's about it. But 18 to 20 really sounds the best. So you should really know what the sequence is, and you should know what the timing is. So once again, you don't have to fool with this when you get to mastering. So those are just a number of things that you should keep in mind when you're mixing, just to make your mastering a whole lot faster and a whole lot more efficient and cheaper as well. My guest today is Pete Lyman, and he's one of the owners of Infrasonic Mastering in Los Angeles. Infrasonic is one of the few mastering studios that still specializes in cutting vinyl lacquers, and we're going to talk a whole lot more about that. I spoke with Pete from his studio via Skype. So cool, Pete. Thanks so much for being with me today. You're one of the few mastering engineers that actually cut vinyl, and everybody is so interested in that. Thanks so much for taking some time.
Yeah, of course. Happy to be here.
You know, let's start at the beginning. How did you become a mastering engineer?
Yeah, it's really strange. I just kind of stumbled into it. Years, you know, I grew up ever since I was, 14 years old. I was, playing in rock bands and touring from the age of 16 on. And I started early on tinkering with recording, four-track recording, various types of live recordings, and then got into, multi-track recording in the early 90s, just basically out of necessity. So I was playing music and I needed a way to record it. And I was never really happy with the studios that I went into. I'm from Colorado and there weren't a lot of options back then. So I just slowly got into recording. The mastering end sort of started by accident. I was with a buddy who owned a record label, and this was probably 16, 17 years ago. And we were just going to go have lunch. And he's like, "Hey, I'm getting a record cut. You want to come see it?" And I'm like, "Yeah, of course." So we went to the mastering studio and met a guy named Richard Simpson, who I basically taught me everything I know. And I watched the record being cut, and it, I can't really explain how I felt, but it just kind of completely changed my life. It was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. And, you know, as a record collector, you know, for years before that, I never really thought too much about that process. And I didn't really focus on the mastering process. I didn't really think much of it and didn't have a very good understanding of what it really entailed until that time. So the next day, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And a couple days later, I walked back into his mastering studio and basically begged him to let me scrub his toilets and do whatever I could to learn the craft. And that's how I got started.
So you started right in with vinyl then?
I started with lacquer cutting. That's the kind of the last of the old school way to, you know, the last foot in the door with mastering. That was sort of the, you know, the way a lot of the original guys learned. I mean, you know, mastering was cutting lacquers. That's what it was.
Yeah.
So it was a really, it was a great way to learn. And even, you know, the two engineers I have here, one's my assistant, one has been cutting lacquers for about 3.5 years now. That's how I've started both of them as well.
You know, it's really interesting because I did this book with Ken Scott, who's one of the five Beetle engineers. And, mm-hmm. you know, he was, in the book, he talks about how you became an engineer in the Abbey Road system, the EMI system. And one of the interesting things was you become a second engineer, then they put you in mastering before you yep. became a first engineer, because they figured that mastering was so much harder than being an engineer. So you should learn what was going on in the hardest, you know, what was going on vinyl, because then you'd be able to be a better engineer as a result. So that's kind of cool. And of course, we've lost that these days because, you know, mastering is a black art to most people.
Yeah, well, that's exactly how Richard Simpson started. I mean, he worked for RCA for almost 40 years, and he started as, you know, basically an assistant, and then he was upgraded to the tape punch guy, so he'd just sit at the multi-track and punch things in, and then he QC'd records, and then right after that, he was, you know, they threw him into mastering. And I think, you know, it's a really interesting way to get involved with this business, and I think as an audio engineer, understanding how all of this work we do translates to these different mediums is really important. And I think even a lot of mastering guys that haven't had the chance to cut lacquers really, you know, they've learned through experience, but it's, you know, it's a nice advantage to start that way and understand how things translate.
How long did it take you before you got good at it?
Yeah. Wow. Really long time. I would go into Richard's studio probably 3-4 days a week after work. And back then, late 90s, early 2000s, for a long time, I was an IT guy. I worked for a IT telecom company and managed groups of engineers, basically. So a completely different field. So I'd work my normal, you know, suit and tie day job, and I would go to the studio as soon as I got off work, and I would cut records. So I really think that it's hard to say when I got good at it. You're always learning. I mean, I'm still learning new things today, but before I guess good enough to send out an actual master lacquer, it was months before I did that. And that was under Richard's supervision, and, you know, even longer before I was really cutting stuff on my own.
But the interesting thing is lacquers cost so much that it costs you a lot to practice, doesn't it?
It's very expensive. Yeah, it can be very expensive.
A
lacquer we use for a 12-inch master, and that's just one side. The price is right now, I think it's about $36 a lacquer, which doesn't really seem like a ton of money, but if you take into account the materials alone to cost one record, to cut one record, are probably a little over $100, not counting the wear and tear on your machine, you know, and that's including the stylus, gets pretty expensive. You make one mistake and you're you've already lost money.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why do you think vinyl is so popular these days?
I think vinyl is popular because it's the only, it's really the only viable physical medium. I mean, I remember being young and loving records, and all of a sudden CDs came out, and CDs were great because, you know, you could move them around and they were a little bit more convenient. But the first thing I noticed was that the artwork just sucked. You know, so you take this great 12 by 12 sleeve and then shrink all the artwork down onto this tiny package. And it's just not as engaging. And I think with vinyl, and I've said this before in other interviews, but to me, vinyl, listening to a record is more like watching a film, and listening to a CD is more like watching a sitcom or something on TV. You know, I think when you're listening to a record on vinyl, it's the full experience like the artist intended. And it's just, to me, it's the ultimate way to listen to music rather than to just have things shuffling around on your iPod while you're doing the dishes or whatever. Generally, when you're listening to a record, you're engaged, like you're actually, like you would be when you're watching a film, as opposed to like watching some reality TV show where you might be doing that and you're on Facebook or whatever, and then you're doing the dishes, you know.
Yeah.
Like vinyl is a really exciting listening experience.
You know, the other thing about vinyl that I always thought was important was the fact that you're actually limited in time on each side, which is a good thing, because when you go back and look at all the classic albums, they're relatively short as compared to CDs. I mean, you're looking at 35 to 45 minutes, which is a perfect amount of time to engage in something. And once you go beyond that, it just seems like then it becomes kind of a chore, you know?
I agree. That's one of my favorite things. The limitations are the some of the best parts of the vinyl experience, because really, who wants to listen to a record that's over 40 minutes? It's you know, I mean, look at all the great examples of, I mean, like almost every Beatles record, you know, every most great records were in that kind of like 35 to 40 minute mark.
Yeah.
And, you know, having said that, there are a lot of great records that are a lot longer, and I enjoy those too. But like for one piece of vinyl, side A and side B, you know, keeping it under 40 minutes, you know, preferably even 18 minutes a side, I just think that's, you know, people's attention starts to sort of wander after anything longer than that.
Well, not only that, just the fact that you can do it just a side if you want. And again, it's an easy chunk of time to be able to digest and to be able to actually commit to, I think. And that's really important. And one of the things we've gotten away from, in my opinion, and I wish we get back to it.
Well, it's funny now, because as we're cutting a lot of vinyl again, we're dealing with a lot of younger artists that, you know, in some cases never even really purchased vinyl, and they don't understand the limitations. I mean, I was just talking with a client earlier who wanted to do a 27 and a half minute side. It's like, yeah, I can do it, but I don't recommend it. You know, just because it can be done doesn't mean it should be done.
Yeah.
You know, and it's never going to sound as good as that 18-minute side.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how much lacquer cutting do you do? What part of your business is that?
Oh, well, we have, including myself, there's three of us here cutting. And I would say we're cutting, the lathe is running probably, with total of three guys, probably 75 hours a week.
Wow.
Of cutting. It's you know, we do a lot of cutting. It's a pretty good percentage, maybe close to 50% of what we do. I mean, these days I'm not cutting every single day. I cut a couple times a week, and two of my other engineers are cutting quite a bit, because I've got, you know, so much just general mastering work right now, but we stay really busy.
Yeah, sounds like it. Well, how difficult is it to maintain the lathes? I know you have two of them. Is the second one up and running yet?
It will be shortly. I actually ended up sending my Neumann back to my technician in Michigan, who's working on it right now. We it's 90% there, but we're doing some cool new modifications to it that I can't really talk about yet, but they'll be pretty exciting when they're done. But they can be really difficult to maintain. A couple months ago, I I had a major fault with one of my Scully lathes. I have a pretty rare Scully lathe. That was the last Scully made. There were only 9 of them ever made. And the one I have is serial number. It's the first serial number in that model series. So it's not only one of 9. It's also the prototype. So it's different from all the rest. And there's one guy in the United States that knows that lathe.
Huh.
So I had a major electrical fault. The power supply went into an overvoltage mode and fried everything in the lathe. So what I thought was going to be flying a tech out for 5 days to fix it ended up being flying my tech out for 2 months to basically live here and work around the clock to get it fixed. So one little thing and, you know, you're into a $35,000 repair.
Wow.
So that's you know, fortunately, we sort of use that as a chance to do some pretty amazing upgrades to that lathe as well. And my tech pretty much re-engineered the entire lathe, and it's better than ever. But they're really difficult and really expensive because the pool of technicians that can work on these things are very small. I mean, in the U.S., you have Chris Muth, Len Horowitz here in California, who's my main tech, and a guy in Michigan named Dylan Constantwall, who's my other tech, and he's one of the guys currently working on new lathe technology. Maybe one of 3 people in the world that are really working on new stuff right now. So it's
new lathe technology? Does that mean that someone is going to reintroduce a lathe?
I probably shouldn't say yet, but I think I would be willing to bet that it's being worked on.
Wow.
I think there's enough of a demand now that I know I've heard rumblings that there are some people in Europe that are working on new record presses, which really important. Record presses haven't been made in probably 60 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a handful of people that are already currently working on, you know, things like new cutting heads, new pitch technology to manage the land. And, you know, I can only assume those same guys are thinking about doing some sort of lathe as well.
Wow. That's the first I've heard this, but it's very cool if that would happen. It just goes to show you that there really is a resurgence.
Yeah. I mean, I think that'll take a long time, and I haven't seen any like direct evidence that that's what's happening, but I can only infer based on everything else that's going on. You know, it's a pretty small community, so when things like that happen, you know, you sort of catch wind of it, and you know, this is all obviously hearsay at this point, but there's some smart guys out there that I know that want that to happen, and we really need it to happen because maintaining this equipment is very difficult. So to have something modern that's a little bit more reliable would be great.
When you're mastering, do you do a separate master for lacquer?
I always, part of my process, I'm able to, when I'm doing digital and vinyl, and I know we're cutting vinyl, I'm able to basically capture a high resolution version without any loudness limiting. And generally, that's what I use for the vinyl cut, along with, you know, there'll be certain changes made in EQ, and maybe you know, we might have to center some of the low frequencies a little bit, apply some more de-essing. But that's what I do for a lot of projects. In a perfect world, I would rather do a ground up remastering for vinyl. And we do that on occasion whenever we can, but most people don't have the budget for 2 separate mastering appointments, you know, one for digital and one for vinyl. It gets pretty expensive. But because I do so much vinyl, I'm able to anticipate what's going to happen when we cut. So just by having a high resolution version without any loudness limiting makes a huge difference. Well, you know, the volume of the digital file has nothing to do with how loud we're going to cut the record. So having a more dynamic version for vinyl is always better.
Now, when you say high resolution, are you saying you mean 9624?
You know, it really depends. I mean, I work in whatever resolution the mix engineer was working in. So if they send me 2444-1, that's where we stay. generally. So, and these days it's a mix. I've been getting a lot of 48K projects in. Actually pretty surprised, but you know, still get our fair share of 96, 88 to 96. Probably once every month we get something 192.
Well, here's a good question for you. In your opinion, what sounds better? What format consistently sounds better to you?
What format or what?
What resolution?
It's kind of a mixed bag because I think 192 can sound great, but I think the most important thing is getting the sounds. You know, I'd rather know that engineers are spending time making sure the instruments are in tune and making sure the vocals sound good rather than worrying about what sample rate they're recording at. I mean, I get a lot. I've got a handful of producers that do epic work that send everything through at 48. I have some guys that send stuff through at 44.1. And then every once in a while, I receive a project at 192 that frankly sounds like garbage. So it's, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out. If it wasn't tracked well, if the instruments didn't sound good, then it doesn't matter what resolution you're recording at. But 192, when it's a spectacular recording that's done right, 192 sounds really good. But having said that, like, you know, most of the projects I get in these days are probably 48 or 96K.
Yeah. You know, I was camped out at a studio in Glendale 5, 6, 7 years ago called Front Page, which isn't there any longer. But we decided we were going to do the experiments one day, and we had three rigs that were set up at 48, 96, and 192. And it was just amazing. The 192 was so good. It was surprising. I always liked 96K, but putting up against 192, and of course it was acoustic, you know, material that we're doing and organic things to see, you know, if we can really tell a difference. Boy, I'll tell you. Now, I've heard all sorts of people say, oh, you know, it's garbage, it's not going to work, and there's all sorts of technical reasons that they give, but I heard it. That's all I can say.
No, yeah, but I think you're right, too. I think it really depends on the type of music.
Yes.
I know this sounds crazy, but sometimes, you know, when I'm doing kind of more gritty rock and roll stuff, sometimes I feel like 48K is just right for it.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, if it sounds good and the mixes are great, then, you know, I'm not super worried about it. But, you know, I also think it has a lot to do with the converters that were used. You know, obviously higher end converters are going to sound better than, like, you know, old DigiDesign 192s at 192.
Yeah.
So I think if you're using, you know, if you're recording at home and you're on like an M box or a Digi O2 or something, I would say stay at 48K rather than 96. I think those things personally sound better at single, you know, sample rates rather than double sample rate. In my experience, just being a guy that's listened to a ton of that stuff.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your room for a second. You have a very, very cool room that you built from the ground up, right?
Yeah.
Well, what did you do differently to fit your needs as a mastering engineer than the normal person would do when they're building a studio?
Well, a couple things. You know, we were, our old facility, which was out in East Los Angeles, we had, you know, a 2,200 square foot recording studio. We had three buildings, a separate building that was a mastering room, which was about the size, maybe a little smaller than my current room, but it was a standalone building, and then office space. And we wanted three mastering rooms and with room to expand. So I wanted to make sure that I had a room kind of similar dimensions to my old room, because I loved my old room. I just didn't love the location and there was no room to expand. But I wanted to make sure that, you know, obviously it sounded really good, that it was an interesting place to spend time in. I mean, we spent a lot of time at work and I want to work in a room that I enjoy being in, even when I'm not playing music in here, you know? So I want it to be aesthetically pleasing and still sound great. And it had to be able to accommodate, had to have space for a lathe and for at least 2 to 3 clients in the back. So we, when we found the building, you know, we purchased a building in 2012 with our friends from Vintage King, and we've always worked pretty closely with them. So they were getting ready to expand, and so were we. So we bought this building and pretty much split it down the middle, tore everything out, including the roof, and started from scratch. So we had a blank slate. You know, we had almost 4,000 square feet to work with. So we built 2 identical mastering rooms. And one of the rooms we currently have a producer named Jake Sinclair working out of. So he's actually songwriting and recording instruments in the other room, and it's working out great for him. And then we have a smaller mastering room that's strictly vinyl cutting, and we're going to be setting up a third lathe here probably in February or March in another room. So I just wanted to make sure that I had, you know, a nice comfortable space that I really enjoyed, sounded great, and room to expand.
Yeah. But did you do anything acoustically that was different, or isolation wise or whatever?
Yeah. All the floors and, you know, everything's floating. We had a designer named Rob Moon come in and do the design. So we hired some general contractors to do like the office areas, the restrooms, all of that. And then we had a designer, you know, build the mastering studio. So they're all decoupled from the foundation, floating floors, the whole bit, you know, bass trapping built into the room.
Okay. So how about your signal chain?
You know, I like to use the least amount of gear as possible. That's kind of my philosophy. Having said that, I guess maybe I have quite a bit of gear, but, some of the key pieces, I use a Massalik transfer console, the MTC-1, which I love. I use Burl converters pretty much exclusively these days. I love them. I've loved them from the first time I tried them. And there's a lot of other converters I like as well, but I just have a good workflow going with the Burls. And I use the Antelope stuff. I've got the Atomic Clock and the Trinity. Shadow Hills Mastering compressor, the Alicia Alpha compressor, Sontech EQ, Dangerous Backs, the Inward Connections EQ, a couple other weird pieces. Probably the weirdest piece I have an old E-Tech bass and treble limiter that was used specifically for cutting. That's pretty interesting. And I use it a lot for, you know, for analog mastering. It's the high frequency limiting. It's great. And I think that's one of the things that people really miss about those classic sounding records is, you know, that a little bit of that HF limiting on the top that was always needed for vinyl. You know? So it does a really good job at that. So yeah, that's kind of my signal chain. I try to keep, if I'm not using it, I keep it out of the chain.
Very cool. Yeah. So you're going in and out of the analog domain then, right?
Yeah, always.
Yeah.
Well, 99% of the time. Yeah. I'd say maybe 1 or 2 instances a year where I get a project that, you know, maybe it's already really slammed and, you know, it just wouldn't do a lot of good going in and out. So, but yeah, I like the workflow. I mean, to be honest, I wish I could work all in the box, you know?
Yeah.
It would, but I like the workflow. I like that. I like knobs in front of me. I like the tactical sort of feeling. I like to be able to grab an EQ without a mouse and just close my eyes and listen to what's going on.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if, you know, digital stuff's getting pretty good, and one day maybe if I feel like it's better than any of my analog gear, then maybe that's the way I'll go. But it's definitely, I definitely don't feel that right now.
How about your speakers? How did you come to, you have PMCs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you decide on those as being the right ones for you?
Well, just listening to a lot of speakers. I have a little bit of an advantage because my business partner who owns half of Infrasonic is also, you know, one of the West Coast sales managers for Vintage King. So when we owned our previous studio before VKLA existed here, we sort of acted as not quite their showroom, but a little bit of their like demo room. So people would, you know, we set up speakers in there. People would come check it out when we had downtime. So I got to listen to a lot of speakers, and the PMCs just blew me away. I think I heard that I have the BB5s, and I think I heard the IB1s maybe first, the smaller ones. And I just loved them. And honestly, there's a lot of other speakers I love. I absolutely love ATCs, and I could work on ATCs as well. And they were, I was definitely thinking about a pair of ATCs, but in the end I went with the PMCs because I really liked the top end.
Yeah, just
something about it. And, you know, as a company, they're great. They've been really good to us. And I just love these speakers. I can't really imagine working on anything else.
They're full range, right? You don't need a subwoofer, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can. A lot of people have the what do they call it? The MB2 setup, which is 3 15-inch subs. So it's two more cabinets. And I'll probably end up doing that next year, you know.
Got to hear that low end, huh?
Yeah. You definitely, I mean, these things are really flat. I can't remember the specs on them, but you definitely don't need extra subs. But, you know, it's kind of fun to have a couple, four more subs in the room.
Yeah.
You know.
So what's the most fun you have in mastering?
I think the really fun projects are, there's one producer who I work with a lot, this guy named Dave Cobb out of Nashville that I've known for a long time, and we've got to do a lot of really cool records together. And we did a record about a year ago for a guy named Jason Isbell, and that was probably one of my favorite records I've ever done, and it was a blast to do because, you know, Dave called me up, and Dave's just the nicest guy, and he gets really excited. He's like, man, you're not going to believe this. This record is crazy. You're going to freak out when you hear it. And so before you even hear it, he gets you so pumped on it. You're just really excited to work on it. And, you know, that was a really fun record because we just worried about making it sound good. It's, in today's standards, a fairly quiet record. And that was, you know, we didn't do any, there was maybe a tiny bit of limiting on it, just a tiny bit. Every decision that was made on that record was just based on, you know, like how good can we make this sound? Not how loud can we make this sound and still be okay, you know? So that was a blast. And it's funny because it turns out that no one has, you know, that record just like swept the AMAs a week ago. No one has complained about it not being as loud as, you know, whatever other loud country record is out there.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show that you don't always have to blast everything, and that, you know, hopefully consumers are just going to like the record for the songs, and they're not going to worry that it's not as loud as the Beyonce song that comes on shuffle after that track, you know?
What, is there a problem that you consistently see with some of the masters that you get?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the usually sort of when you're dealing with mixers that maybe don't have as much experience or are working in a room that's new to them or a room that's just not set up, I think one of the biggest issues you have is just with low end. And it's the hardest thing to get right in a room. And a lot of project studio owners, you know, they really struggle with it because it's always a compromise when you're in a project studio. You're trying to like squeeze as much gear as you can into, you know, your back room or your garage or whatever. And it's usually less than ideal acoustically. So, you know, struggling with the low frequencies and the relationship between the kick and the bass and getting that to sit right in the mix, that's usually the biggest issue that we run into.
Do the mixes you get do you find that they're really crushed?
It really depends. Sometimes they are. And there's some guys that I work with, it's usually, you know, the kind of more, I would say, bigger major label pop stuff. And there's a few guys I work with that send me their mixes and they're limited. They're as loud as they're going to make them. But they do such a good job at it. This is how they want their track to sound. And we're we're just making sure everything's okay with it. And, you know, in those instances, we're just sort of, you know, in some cases doing nothing almost, just heads and tails and making sure it sounds as good as it can. And I think that's another important thing that people overlook in mastering. And I think a lot of even like newer guys that are getting into mastering feel like they have to manhandle every mix, you know? And I think if a mix sounds good, sometimes your job is to do nothing. It's very rare. Those jobs happen maybe once a year or once every 2 years. Usually it always needs something, but I think you need to show some restraint and know when enough's enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Very cool. Last question. What's the best piece of business advice, music business advice, that either someone imparted to you or you've learned over the course of your time in the business?
Wow. I feel like I've learned a lot of lessons the hard way. I think if you're going to start a business, come up with a solid business plan. So I was really lucky when my partner Jeff and I started our studio together. I had a small project studio and we met up and he's like, let's do a real studio. And so what we did is we maxed out all our credit cards and bought a bunch of gear and went down to Home Depot and built out the studio ourselves. I don't recommend doing that. if I could go back and change that, I probably would. But I learned a lot, and I made it through. And we got lucky that we didn't make too many mistakes. But I think before you go out and start spending, you know, $50,000 on speakers and buying all this gear, I think it's important to, you know, on the business side of things, come up with a business plan and make sure that you're not overextending yourself. Like, gear is great, but gear is not what's really important, especially in mastering. Like, you want to have a great signal chain and you want to have good gear, but the most important thing are your ears, acoustics, speakers, and, you know, the room. You know, concentrate on that before you go out and buy five different EQs.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that'll help you in the long run. And just make sure don't overextend yourself. You know, all the gear will come and, you know, get what you need to get started and do good work. And, you know, that's how you're going to build up your clientele. And ultimately, clients don't really care what gear you have anyways. I mean, some do. I find when I run into those people, they're generally like usually not people that I'm that interested in working with.
Yeah.
I think the most important thing are the results and, you know, your ears. And that's what you should focus on.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it. This is great. I knew it would be, and it certainly was.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Are you you coming down here for AES?
You bet. You bet I am.
Well, see you in a couple weeks.
See you, Pete.
To find out more about Pete and Infrasonic, go to infrasonicsound.com. That's infrasonicsound.com, I-N-F-R-A, sonicsound.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Thanks a lot, Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the Producer Podcast at theproducer.club. He helps with the editing and putting it all together. Thanks a lot, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and you can select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll also find a sign-up sheet for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I'll see you next time.